Thanks for listening to the podcast from Faith Radio Mornings.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Good morning, friends. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Thanks for joining us this morning on Faith Radio Mornings. Bill Arnold here with Rebecca Maxwell at the board and Paul Perreault in the newsroom. What an interesting conversation we just had with Dr. Bruce Ashford, and he was a fascinating guest. And his advice was, and Rebecca, you can chime in on this, how careful you have to be on social media as you engage people in political discussion without tarnishing your witness and your faith.
It's a big challenge, and I think it's one that we face probably far too many times a day if you engage as much as I do. And maybe that's a personal problem, I'm not quite sure. But it is a careful balance, because we do want to engage in the issues of the moment. I think that there's eternal truth can be applied in any situation. But we always have to remember we're talking to real people.
Yes.
About their real lives, and that ultimately they're not the enemy, and it's not a competition that we're set to win, that we're seeking to share God's love with them. And if that's our ultimate motivation, then I think that should just kind of carry through no matter what the topic is, whether it's politics or sports or the food you had last night.
Right.
I think maintaining the motivation should probably be primary rather than winning or coming up with the best quip of the day.
I have a friend who's kind of a movie star, television star.
Ooh.
And you would know exactly who I was talking about. And he is very liberal, obviously lives in Hollywood, and he puts up many rants a day that are very politically left-oriented. And if you were to contradict any of those, you would get a big whopping dose of opposition. And so I'm not even on Facebook, so I don't engage with him on that level. But I oftentimes just send him text messages saying, hey, I was thinking of you today, and hey, I saw that thing you did, and just want to tell you I love you and hope you're doing good and the kids are good. And
encouraging him on a personal level.
Oh, my. Yeah. And he just gushes back. And I think if he really knew all of my political opposition to some of his opposition, we would maybe stop being friends. Because
that's
how passionate he can be against people that oppose the agenda.
And that can be really it's a challenging environment in which to live as Christians. I think most of us would acknowledge that no matter what your political leanings. But I also think that God has created us for such a time as this.
Mm-hmm.
I think it is for this moment that we all have been put right here and right now. And our question is just, okay, how is that going to work itself out today? What opportunities is God going to place in front of me in my life today? And may my eyes be open to see it.
Right. I would tell you who my friend is, but I'm not into name dropping.
Mm.
Al Pacino told me that. He told me that at Robert De Niro's barbecue. Said, do not name drop. He told me that personally, so I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to name drop. I don't think it's polite.
I appreciate your restraint.
Thank you. All right. We have Dr. Omar Hamada on the line, and we cannot wait to get to know him. So we'll take a little break, and we'll be right back. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Bill Arnold here. Dr. Omar Hamada served 15 years in the United States Army, the last 10 of which were with the U.S. Special Forces as a flight surgeon and diving medical officer. How cool is that? Excuse me. He's my guest right now. And how cool is that, Rebecca? Come on. You got to just say that.
I can't wait to hear his story.
I can't
either.
Absolutely. I know. He is married with 4 kids. He lives in Tennessee. Dr. Hamada, welcome to the show.
Hey, Bill. Great to be on.
Oh, no
Thank
kidding.
You.
You do it all. Yours is so cool.
I don't play golf.
Okay, well, that's actually even cooler, because it's like shooting pool outside. It's like a skill sport. You don't actually get any exercise really about golf. But anyway, I digress. I want to hear about your story. Tell me about your life.
Wow. How much time do we have?
We've got a couple minutes, so I need the condensed version.
Fantastic. So I was born in Tallahassee and of Lebanese immigrant parents, and have lived sort of all over the world. My dad was first a college professor and then a minister and missionary and author. We dealt with basically teaching Western Christians on the methods and needs of Muslim evangelism, so converting Muslims to Christ, and worked with a lot of great mission organizations that you guys know, and I won't name drop, like you said.
Right, it's not polite to name drop.
That's right.
Yeah.
So, and then, you know, got into, long story, but in Lebanon, my family were all involved in, you know, politics and religion and the military. Got here and really had some of that still in my blood. Well, I was born in Tallahassee, so, you know, had that in my blood, and ended up with my six M's, married with four kids. My wife is also a physician, MBA, went back and got an MBA at Vandy once I realized that healthcare was broken and we needed something different, so I could have some credibility sitting at the table with all the other business folks. Ministry, I'm an ordained minister, went to seminary at Columbia in South Carolina. Military, like you said, in for about 15 years, and 10 of those in the Special Forces as a flight surgeon and diving medical officer.
What is a diving medical officer? What is that?
Well, basically, you know, a flight surgeon, we deal with people that are in high altitudes and in flight medicine, aerospace stuff. Diving medicine, basically hyperbarics and deep sea medicine. We have dive teams in the Special Forces, just like you think of, you know, the Navy SEALs.
Okay.
So you want to be able to, you know, deal with problems that occur at depth is what we say. So let's see, marriage, MBA, ministry, medicine, military, medicine, yeah. I'm an MD and board certified in family medicine, sports medicine, OBGYN, actually board eligible in sports. And we have a concierge practice dealing with genomics and personalized medicine, and that's one thing I know we're going to talk about this morning, hopefully. And then also music, classically trained as a spinto tenor in the style of Mario Lanza, believe it or not, in New York and Vienna.
Omar, I'm trying not to feel inadequate right now.
Well, you shouldn't, because all that was sort of, you know, slid into.
Okay. I mean, I dropped out of junior college and I cut lawns part-time for a while. So, you know, I'm a little bit like you, okay?
Fantastic.
Thank you so much. All right,
We're all like...
Let's talk about genomes. I don't even know what they are.
Okay, so let's start here, if you don't mind.
No,
so healthcare is broken and it's not working, you know, and we're spending so much money on it and... The results are really pitiful. I mean, people are still getting sick and taking a bunch of medicine. And I think, you know, the way it's gone now is traditional medicine is really just what we call chronic disease management.
Yes.
Or essentially sick care. I mean, you know, you have hypertension, high blood pressure, or diabetes, or kidney failure. And all we do is we basically manage it. And what that means is we just give you more and more medications. And that's all we can really do, right, in the current system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for various reasons. But now we realize, as far as technologies come, we can actually personalize our medicine and reverse diseases. So we're really focusing on genomics. So, but what that is your personalized genetic code, what your cells are encoded to do. We can actually know what that is now by doing some simple blood tests and figuring out what your genetics look like, and then we can go back and personalize medical care to you. And then try to get you off these medicines and get you healthy and get you virile and energetic and, you know, flexible again and strong again, like we felt like we were in our 30s, most of us.
Well, this sounds unbelievably encouraging. And how is all this?
It really is.
Yeah. When is this going to start? Is it happening now?
It really is. Yeah, it's already happening. There are still a few places. It's just not widespread. So a guy named Peter Diamandis, who got his MD at Harvard and his PhD, I think, in aerospace at MIT, sort of paired up with a few people, including Craig Venter, who sequenced the human genome in 2003. And he started something called HLI, Human Longevity Institute, in San Diego. You might have heard of Peter through his connections with a guy named Elon Musk.
Oh, yeah.
With SpaceX and XPRIZE and Singularity University. So Peter, you know, started this, and that's sort of, you know, what we have triggered off of. Ran into Dr. Diamandis at Strategic Coach in Chicago with Dan Sullivan, and then another colleague of mine, Jeff Gladden, as well, who's doing this in Dallas. So my wife and I decided to try to do this in the Nashville area, and what it is just amazing stuff. There are a lot of like, you know, Vanderbilt University and Duke University and others are using genomics in certain areas. But I don't think very many, maybe half a dozen nationwide right now, are using it in this capacity in terms of strictly personalizing medicine to the individual.
Mm-hmm. All right. I've got a couple more questions for you, but we do need to take a little break. When we come back, lots more with Dr. Omar Hamada. Be back in a minute. Seventeen minutes after the hour, talking to Dr. Omar Hamada. We're talking about this very interesting idea of personalized medicine treatment. And Dr. Hamada, when you talk about this and you do gene testing, let's say, for example, if you can give me an illustration, if I had like a hyperactive thyroid or something and you did this testing, could you then, through the testing, figure out exactly how to help me regulate that?
Yeah, in some ways. So there are different kinds of genetic tests, and we try to actually cover most of them in this. So, for example, let's say you're having trouble losing weight and you don't know why. You're on calorie restriction, and you're exercising and you're still not losing it. Well, we can actually go in and do genetic tests and see exactly why it is and see what your cells are doing and what your metabolism is like and the genes that are turned on and the genes that are turned off. And we can go in there, and with some lifestyle changes and supplements and dietary modification, we can actually go in there and switch the bad genes off and the good genes on in a lot of ways. We call that epigenetics.
Okay.
Every
phone line just lit up. In other words, there's going to be people saying, how do I go find out more about this?
Yeah. So one way is you can visit our website. It is www.primdev.com, and in French that is Prime of Life, and you spell it PRIMDEVIE, and it all runs together, primdev.com.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's what we're doing there.
Okay. How is this going to impact healthcare? You say it's in shambles, and is this personalized medicine going to be something that's going to help us get out of this mess?
Unfortunately not, because the government and insurance companies and all are really focused on one thing. The government is focused on cost controls and public health, which means they don't want to individualize it. It's going to be what is best for the community as a whole, for the country as a whole. And people are going to drop through the holes, holes in the sieve. And insurance companies are worried about how do we maximize our profits on the end so we can increase your stock price and this and that, and pharmaceutical companies too. So looking over the whole thing, no, that's not going to work. But where it does work is when we say, you know, we are taking control of our health as individuals, it's important enough to us, and we're paying for it out of pocket. And unfortunately, it's not cheap still.
Right.
It's still fairly expensive.
Can you comment on the impact of the healthcare regulations on the doctor and patient relationship? That seems to be strained.
It is awful because now patients don't trust doctors, and doctors, are starting to be annoyed with patients. But it's really the third parties that are in the middle that are causing the problems: the insurance companies, the hospitals, the government, the pharmaceutical companies, because they have different incentives than we do. Initially, medicine was a message between a physician and their patient, and it was a message of hope and healing. And unfortunately, that's been kidnapped and hijacked by these other parties who saw, you know, there's a good way to make a lot of profit here, a lot of money. And now they've set us against one another. And it's really damaged not just the relationship, but it's damaged the whole business of healthcare, the whole message of medicine.
Does it seem that in previous times you went into the doctor's office and he greeted you, and now the doctor walks in and sits right down at the computer and looks at the screen?
Yes, and we blame the doctor, but it's not the doctor's fault. I mean, it is our fault of how we behave, but we are commodities now, not professionals anymore, and we are told how to practice, when to practice, how many patients to see, and how to document. So our entire focus is, am I documenting correctly so I don't get slapped or, you know, money taken away? because, you know, we're getting reimbursed 30 cents on the dollar, et cetera. You know, not doctors make a good living, but it's just the regulations are so intense that it's almost impossible to practice good medicine, because now it's just the business of healthcare rather than the message of medicine.
And then I had this weird feeling that every piece of information that my doctor will compile about me will somehow get to the government. Is that true, or is that just my paranoia?
No, it is true, but not, you know, what we talk about is personalized health information with all these HIPAA regulations. And a lot of that, I think, is also unwise and stupid. But needless to say, it does get to the government as data in a generic format without any personally identifiable information. But what they are trying to do is, you know, improve their public health models. In other words, how much risk can we take and still not spend so much money?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you're seeing, like, the pap smear changes, no paps until 21, regardless of sexual activity, the mammogram changes, the cancer screening changes, because it's not about the individual patient. It's about public health as a whole. How do we spend less money yet manage the risk appropriately?
And then does the government make you ask certain questions to patients when they come in? Like, I think the doctor said,
no.
Do you have a gun in the house, and do you brush your teeth with bacon? Of course, my answers are no, and then yes.
Yeah, no, they don't make you ask questions like that, but they do incentivize you for complying with their regulations. And then with documentation, if you don't comply with their regulations, they come back and they audit you, and then they take money back. And sometimes they actually throw doctors in jail.
Oh, fun. That's exciting. So what
yeah.
advice would you have for legislators that are trying to improve the healthcare system? As a doctor, what would you say to them?
Talk to doctors, and for doctors, become legislators, or talk to your legislators. And for doctors, I think, you know, get an MBA, understand the business of medicine. As doctors, we think, you know, we're smart and we don't need business training because we know how to run a business, and we really don't. We crash them and burn them in general. So I'd say, you know, get some business training and learn the language and get involved.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Tom Price, do you like him?
Yeah, I sure do.
And he is... he's in charge of the overall of Obamacare. Would you say that we're in the right direction with him in charge?
You know, I think so. I like him as a physician. I like him in terms of the way he thinks about business in general, until I think he got to the point of, unfortunately, you know, I think he's doing what he can. But in terms of Obamacare, I think people get to a position and they start doing things to protect it. So, for example, in hospital settings, doctors who work well in hospital settings are those who are willing to sort of lower their heads and do what they're told and not really push back well. Those of us who stand up and say, you know, this is wrong for the patient, this is wrong for the physicians, don't last long in corporate environments. And I'd say the same thing for physicians in legislative and executive positions.
Dr. Hamada, you're also right now, do I have this correct, that you're in emergency care?
Yes, yeah, so I'm doing emergency medicine.
Okay, are you kind of an adrenaline junkie?
Yeah, I guess you could say, although I'm ready for a little bit of rest.
Yeah, because when patients come into your emergency room, and it's a life and death situation all day long, isn't it, for the most part?
You know, it depends where you work. So I used to work in a hospital where a lot of it was drug-seeking behavior.
Okay.
And also, sorry about that, drug-seeking behavior and also chronic pain and all this. Not
okay.
a lot of sick people. Where I'm working right now, there are a lot of sick people. So, yeah, it's a lot of adrenaline.
Yeah, I just think that would be a very difficult job to do day in and day out, because it's often hysteria and you've got to think so fast and life and death is on the line. So God bless you, and we will pray for you today, and we will also ask you to come back and be on the show again, because you were just an amazing guest. And the six M's, I got to work through those again, but very impressive.
Well, I would absolutely love to anytime. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. It is 26 minutes
yes,
after the hour. We'll take a short break, and when we come back after the news, we're going to talk to Dr. Paul Kingor from Grove City College, the Center for Vision and Values. We'll be back in a minute. It is 31 minutes after the hour. We're going to take a little news break. When we come back, Dr. Paul Kengor from the Center for Vision and Values will be on the studio line with us. Be back in a minute. Six minutes after the hour, we know about the fall, but we don't completely understand what the fall did to our experience of this life. Pastor and author Larry Osborne explains.
We preach Genesis 3, but we don't really believe it. We constantly are assuming if we do everything right, if we listen to the Lord enough, if we pray enough, if we have enough faith, then everything will work out. But the truth of the matter is, in this world, everything is broken.
You can find the full interview with Larry at our website at myfaithradio.com. Next up, we've got Dr. Paul Kengor on the studio line. We're going to talk about the update on Neil Gorsuch and other interesting items. Back in a minute.
Have you ever had an old picture come back to haunt you? You know, the ones where you're wearing moon boots and a pair of really, really tight, high-waisted jeans? Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. Our parents tried to warn us, but some lessons can't be learned any other way. And today's teens aren't any different. They'll still adopt peculiar fashions and listen to questionable music, all in the name of fitting in. So if you're perplexed by your child's goofy hairstyle or crazy outfit, take a deep breath. It's probably nothing more than a healthy pursuit of independence and personal validation. Just be sure to take a lot of pictures. Then someday, they can look back and realize how dorky they really looked. Someday, you'll both be laughing.
Is conflict heating up in your home? Learn how to argue effectively with a new free download from Mark Gregston. Go to ParentingTodaysTeens.org.
Okay, it's 37 minutes after the hour. Before we bring on Dr. Paul Kengor, Rebecca, do we have time for a little quick comedy break?
We can.
Okay.
I think.
All right. Here it is.
We'll see if Dr. Kengor thinks it's funny.
All right. Here it is. Girl Scout cookie serving size, 2 cookies. Ha. That's funny. That's very funny.
And bears no resemblance to reality.
No, not at all. Dr. Paul Kengor is at the Center for Vision and Values. He's a regular guest here on the show. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm good. Can you eat
good.
Just two
yeah,
Girl Scout cookies?
We met a few years ago in Cleveland. I don't know if you remember that or not.
Oh, I don't have a memory of anything, Paul. Not a thing. Now, can you eat just two Girl Scout cookies?
Good to talk to you. What's that?
Can you eat just two Girl Scout cookies?
I don't know. I don't eat them. Period.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that wraps up our interview.
Yeah, that's it.
We don't need
to. Needs to be said.
We don't need to continue speaking. No. Where did we meet? Where did we run into each other in Cleveland?
I'm pretty sure it was a pro-life conference in Cleveland.
Oh, yes.
Maybe
I do
about
remember that.
2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I remember you because of, imagine this, the jokes that you told.
Thank you so much. Let's move on.
Yeah.
All right.
Which were very funny.
Thank you so much.
And funnier than the joke you just told about the two cookies.
Kapowee. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. All right, let's talk about Neil Gorsuch, the confirmation grilling that's starting.
Right. Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I thought that the worst statement that was made was by Senator Dianne Feinstein from California, who is, you know, rabidly pro-choice. And she just made a ridiculous statement where she took one of Gorsuch's best statements, which was a statement that he made in a 2006 book that he wrote on euthanasia. And the quote in there was something to the effect of that taking one human person taking the life of another human person is always intrinsically wrong, or something like that. And Feinstein read the exact quote, and she said that just shows how extreme he is. That he would believe that one human being always taking the life of another human being is always wrong. Well, you know, that she said that just shows how extreme he is, and why she can't support this this confirmation. And I don't know how Gorsuch held it together at that point. It would have taken everything that I have to say that ought to show to all the American public, Senator Feinstein, that you are extreme. And frankly, that's a pretty horrifying statement on your part. But that's what we've come to, apparently.
They're working awfully hard to demonize him, aren't they? And it's a hard job
to
do. This guy is pretty near perfect, isn't he?
Yeah, he is pretty near perfect. And I must say, Bill, I really don't – I have a hard time recalling any judicial nominee who has this kind of academic pedigree and credentials. And that's saying a lot, right? I mean, you know, the people who get to this level of the Supreme Court – are the most educated people that you'll find anywhere in the country. But this guy has not only a JD, he actually has a PhD in moral philosophy from Oxford.
Wow.
I mean, you know, the guy is just off the charts educated. And at Oxford, he studied under one of the world's preeminent authorities on natural law, a guy by the name of John Finnis. And Finnis is, to this day, he's now professor emeritus at Oxford, and he teaches at Notre Dame Law School. And Finnis wrote the best work on really one of the preeminent seminal works on natural law. It's called Natural Law and Natural Rights. And Finnis was Gorsuch's dissertation advisor at Oxford. So this is somebody who, you know, he's perfectly qualified from the bench, from, you know, the different circuits that he's served on, from, you know, he has the approval of the American Bar Association, which isn't easy for a conservative. The ABA has become very, very liberal, and his academic qualifications are unimpeachable. So I think at this point, incredibly, it almost looks like it's going to end up being a party line vote, which is outrageous.
Mm-hmm.
If I was advising the Democrats, I would tell them, you know, step forward here and show that you're not partisan hacks. Vote for this guy who there's no reason to possibly vote against, and then save your fire, like we know you're going to anyway, for the next nominee, which is probably going to be not for Justice Ginsburg's replacement or Breyer, but probably somebody like Anthony Kennedy. And, you know, you guys can go bonkers over that poor soul.
Believe me, they will, too.
They will. That's
yes,
right. That's
yes.
right. But for Gorsuch, they're wasting their time.
Oh, I couldn't
agree
more.
They're really showing themselves to be unserious.
Yeah. Paul, I want to talk about the importance of natural law in American governance, but I also want you to just tell our listeners about natural law. What is it?
Yeah, it's a good question. A lot of people have a hard time understanding it, and unfortunately it's not taught like it should be, but natural law basically affirms that we do what we ought to do according to nature, to our very nature. And, you know, that's a nature that we as Christians believe was ordained by the Creator. But frankly, even if you're not a Christian, even if you're not a believer, you could believe that, you know, it's just nature itself. And, you know, to quote Peter Kraft, who's one of the top authorities on this, and I wouldn't be surprised, he's probably quoted in Gorsuch's book, Kraft says that, you know, what we ought to do is based on what we are. You know, moral laws are based on human nature. And so this natural law is naturally known by natural human reason and experience. Now, that might be may or may not be hard for some people to understand, but I what I found with natural law, Bill, is it's better to give examples.
Yeah, please do.
For people to understand.
That's my next question.
Yeah. So, for example, human sexuality is a really easy example because it's self-evident. If you look at sexuality between a man and a woman, it's obviously evident that the two have different sexual parts that are distinctly different but complementary,
mm-hmm.
Those parts come together for the reproduction of life. I mean, a male sperm fertilizes a female egg, and that leads to life. You know, that's how the laws of nature or nature's God that has ordained it. That's just quite simply the way it is. I give an example with college students and people that I speak to around the country, and you'll laugh at this, Bill, and everybody listening will laugh, but unfortunately you have to give absurd examples nowadays to young people to try to make some of these points. But there's a fringe movement out there now called the eco-sex movement, which is actually a group of very strange people who advocate sexual communion with nature. And I tell my students, as an example of natural law, I tell them, look, if you try to have sex with a tree, you're going to get hurt because you weren't made or evolved to try to have sex with a tree. If you try to have sex with a tree, that is a violation of the natural law. A human being wasn't made to have sex with a tree. And I give that example because everybody gets it, and no one stomps out of the room in angry protest, right? But they understand it. They get that point. Now, they get angry if I give another example, which is that, you know, two men, their body parts weren't designed to go together either. You know, two men that come together cannot become one flesh, and one cannot, you know, maybe I shouldn't be this blunt on this morning Christian show, but, you know, one man can't, and another man coming together cannot produce a child,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, the two women, likewise, cannot consummate a marriage in that same way. And this is when you start to apply natural law to contemporary issues that liberals get very angry, and this is why they want to reject natural law.
Yeah.
But they can't because natural law is what it is.
Yeah, Paul, we have to take a little break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. 46 minutes after the hour, be right back. It is 49 minutes after the hour. I'm talking to Dr. Paul Kengor from Grove City College, Center for Vision and Values. We're talking about natural law. And, Paul, what influence did it have on our founders? And how does it differ from the legal philosophies we have today?
Yeah, well, that's a crucial point, and in that it really influenced all of the founders. And, I mean, even Thomas Jefferson, in fact, in the last segment, Bill, I used the phrase laws of nature and nature's God. That's a phrase right out of the Declaration of Independence. That's in the first paragraph by Thomas Jefferson. And Jefferson wasn't exactly known as, you know, the most devout Orthodox Christian, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Jefferson understood that, you know, there were these certain laws of nature and nature's God that were ordained in nature by a creator. Or, you know, here again, even if you're an evolutionist, you can look at the way, in your view, life has evolved and say, well, life has evolved to where a man's reproductive parts fertilize a woman's reproductive parts, and that's how nature has ordained it. So that's the thing about natural law. You can be a believer or a non-believer. But yeah, this was very influential in the founders, the people who put together the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence. They basically all believed in natural law. It's a philosophy that goes back to Aquinas, Augustine, actually St. Paul. I mean, Paul writes about this in the New Testament. So it's right there in Scripture. It really goes back to the Judeo understanding of the importance, the viability of all human life, and it's something that has been important in Christian thought, both Catholic, Protestant, John Calvin. So this has been around for literally a couple thousand years, and if anybody who thinks that Gorsuch is talking about some arcane, weird, new idea or philosophy here, no, that's the fault of the person thinking that. He believes in something that all of the founders believed.
Mm-hmm. Paul, is this being taught in schools, natural law, or is it just
no,
too much conflict?
It's not. It's not being taught in schools. And also, Bill, it's not being taught in our law schools. I had one of my students, one of my Grove City College students, I asked her a couple of years ago when she came back to visit campus. I said, "Hey, did you have any discussion of natural law at all in your program?" She said, "No," and she had one instance where she brought it up at the end of the semester to one of her professors and said, "Hey, why didn't we talk about natural law in this class?" And the professor, very liberal, very progressive, she said to her, "Well, that's because natural law doesn't exist."
Wow.
And yes, exactly. And my students said, "Okay, I understand where you're coming from. I know we disagree politically, but professor, it influenced all of the American founders. Justices Scalia and Thomas and Roberts and Alito, at least half the Supreme Court believes in it. Shouldn't we at least understand it? And the professor just gave her a very annoyed look, like you know, get out of here, you're bothering me. And of course, the answer to that is yes, you should understand it. It's just like if in my Middle East course, when I talk about Islam, I've got to tell my students who Muhammad was, and I've got to read from sections in the Quran. In my Marxism course, I got to have my students read from the Communist Manifesto. I mean, you have to do that. If you're teaching about what Christians believe, you got to read from the Bible. But this is a way that a lot of these so-called tolerant progressives who believe in diversity teach. They exclude ideas that they don't want to tolerate. So they just ignore them. And then they produce a whole bunch of students that come out into the world, and when they hear that someone like Neil Gorsuch believes in natural law, they say, natural law? What's that? Well, he must be some kind of an extremist. Mm-hmm. Who believes in natural law? Because they weren't taught about it.
I love when your voice gets real high. It's good radio.
Thank you. Well, I could do the whole interview in that
voice.
Oh,
please. No, please. I want to try to maintain the listeners I have. Let's just change a little bit to the look at the C-SPAN presidential ranking. And where does Obama rank in all this?
Oh, man. You had to bring that up this morning, didn't you?
Well, you shouldn't have used the high voice.
Yeah, that is... I participated in that C-SPAN survey too. That's what makes it even harder. Obama ranked 12th in the survey, which is not defensible. I mean, it is outrageous. There's no way that you could possibly say that Barack Obama was our 12th greatest president of all time. And if you look at those numbers very closely, which you wouldn't have done, but I had to do because I was part of the survey. There's actually not a great distance in the total number of points between Ronald Reagan at number 9 and Obama at number 12. In fact, if just you flip a couple of us in the survey, or if maybe 3 or 4 of us hadn't have responded, I wouldn't have been surprised if Barack Obama wouldn't have ended up in the top 7 or 8. And that's crazy because otherwise the top 10 was pretty good. Lincoln, Washington, FDR. I don't like FDR, but you know, people agree he was a very effective president, right? Teddy Roosevelt, Harry Truman, Eisenhower, Ronald Reagan. A lot of people that you would expect there, but to have Obama on the cusp of being among the top 10, it's just outrageous. I mean, Obama, I really encourage people to stop and think about this, whether you're from the left or the right. Come up with a list of 10 really important things that Obama did. I mean, it's hard to come up with that list. You can come up with that list for FDR, for LBJ, for Ronald Reagan, for Lincoln, for Washington, for Teddy Roosevelt, but not really for Obama. So I just thought that was really outrageous.
Yeah, Paul, we just have a minute left. What do we look for in a great leader?
Well, that's a good question, and unfortunately, that poll didn't really ask that question very well. They wanted to know basically how effective was the president. Well, Woodrow Wilson was extremely effective. LBJ was extremely effective. LBJ really got things done, right? But I don't like the things that he did.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I would look for other traits altogether, and you know, I suppose that's an interview we could do another time.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Thanks so much for being on the show, Paul. Always a delight. Have a great day, and I'll talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
All right. It's 56 minutes after the hour. You know, I never know if you're supposed to say Roosevelt or Roosevelt. Is that depends on where you come from?
Well, Dr. Kinger has the PhD, so I'm going to go with his pronunciation.
We're going to go with Roosevelt. All right. We'll be back in just a minute. All right, 58 minutes after the hour. If you have to be at work in a couple minutes, get moving. I hope your morning has been good. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting Faith Radio. We do have our share-a-thon, I think, coming up real soon, so we're excited about that. We always hear such great stories from listeners who listen to the programs and benefit from it, and they're growing in their faith. I'm going to wrap up today's show with Ephesians 1:4. I started with that. For he chose us in him before the creation of the world to be holy and blameless in his sight. Wow. We are holy and blameless in His sight. How awesome is that? Keep listening today. Have a great day. I'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this Faith Radio Mornings podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Faith Radio Mornings, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thanks for sharing the audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings.